Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Limitless Lives. I'm your host, Nilesh Patel. I am thrilled to be joined by Sanjay Patel. As a former monk of over 20 years and guidance from the world's finest mindfulness monks, he has coached over 60,000 people and is recognized as one of the world's most experienced speakers in the fields of mindfulness, mental health, motivation, and meditation. Through evidence-based and self-practice techniques, Sanjay provides clear solutions, making him an inspiring figure in professional and personal development. His expertise extends to topics such as leadership, trust building, emotional intelligence, diversity and inclusion, unity, and success without stress. As an accomplished author and former monk, Sanjay explains how yogic philosophy brings health, happiness, and spiritual wellness, shedding light on the miraculous benefits of yoga and scientifically proven practices to boost health. He's the author of A Yoga Miracle and God is Real. His groundbreaking research has also been recognized by the scientific community worldwide. So get ready for an episode packed with insights and practical considerations to help us all on our journey of exploration, inspiration, and empowerment. Sanjay, welcome to Limitless Lives.
Thanks, Nilesh, for inviting me. It's an honor.
Brilliant. Well, your intro speaks volumes for the journey you've been on, and your path is really quite extraordinary, from embracing the life of a monk to becoming a renowned speaker on mindfulness and meditation. Could you walk us through some of the pivotal moments in your journey that have led you from the monastic life in India to coaching and inspiring thousands across the world?
There are so many, it's difficult to enumerate, but some of the most stunning moments were with my personal engagements with my teacher. And some of the things that he said to me were truly mind-blowing at the time, unexpected, in fact, paradigm-breaking, something which was I had never imagined that he would say. When I entered the monkhood, I was pretty much a very traditional type of person with fairly rigid beliefs and approach, quite orthodox, I might say, a little zealous. I would say that would be quite common for most monks initially. One of the things he said, which just echoed in my mind for many decades, I was quite a rebellious person. So I had 1,000 doubts about the spiritual path, about so many things, even about, you know, mundane life. And my teacher was so open-minded. He would give me his valuable time, listen to my questions and answer them. And one day he asked me a question. I'd have been asking him questions until now. And he asked me a question, quite a simple one. He said, "Which books do you read?" Immediately in my mind, I assumed that he felt the books that I were reading were the cause of so much of my rebellious questions. So I said to him, I said, "I don't read many other books apart from the books that are being taught at the monastery. And I don't have time for reading anything else." And he said to me, he said, "You need to make time. You need to make time and read good books on science so that you can understand and answer all of these questions you are asking me from a scientific perspective." That was an amazing moment for me when I thought that he thought I was reading too much science. Instead, he was encouraging me to read more science, telling me to go even deeper into what I was not reading at the time, in fact, but whatever shallow reading I had had about science or about logic or philosophy. And he told me, go deeper into that. And there I would find many of the answers that I was searching for. And he gave me that freedom, and that he empowered me to do that. I could actually walk out of his room and I could go to the senior monks in the monastery and say, "Look, our teacher has instructed me and we need to buy more books." And I could get that passed. And, you know, books were purchased for me to study. It was amazing, though, that he himself, being an elderly man from India, without any overt scientific background himself, yet he himself told me to study science. And that was a pivotal moment for me. He gave me the freedom to really continue thinking freely and not to be captured in any orthodox thoughts, and to be liberated. And that's what it's all about. Monkhood is about becoming liberated from preconceptions. And he gave me the freedom to do that. It was an amazing moment. There were several incidents of this sort where my teacher empowered me to become mentally free like an eagle, to soar through various thoughts and not to be afraid of doubts, but to engage with doubts to find solutions. So that was one of the most pivotal moments for me in my life, and I still have it today. I'm not afraid to challenge any thought. To run away from a thought is to give in. We've been given brains to engage, and we all have our individual brains. We're not like ants, a queen. The other ants are almost mindless. They follow the mind of the queen. For us, we've all been given an individual brain, just as we've been given our own individual share of legs and hands. The center of all of that is our brain, and in no way does God intend us to throw away our brains. He intends us to use them for the good of humanity. So that was one of the pivotal moments I experienced with my teacher.
Out of curiosity, what were some of the questions you were asking or seeking clarity on, which now in reflection made you think, this is probably why my teacher is asking me to dive even further into my curiosity, into science?
I used to serve as his translator as well, or times when people used to meet him and they were English speaking. So I would be the translator and translate from English to Gujarati, which my teacher used to speak, and then back from Gujarati to English for the guest. And similarly, he was very interested, as I said, you know, in science, in intellectual thought. He engaged with it, and he himself didn't have the time personally to read. But while he was eating, so that would be at 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, he would have people read before him, and they would be reading from magazines and newspapers and things like that, anything which was of interest. And of course, he always insisted that these magazines would be of the highest repute. So at one time, a US magazine came to him, and it had an article on faith and healing. It was written, of course, in the United States by some US writer in a very important national journal. And I was asked to translate it. And in this article, as I was reading, it showed the connection between faith and healing, which had been documented by doctors and by other scientists. So somebody getting cancer and suddenly the cancer disappearing, and the doctor comes and, you know, endorses it and said, yes, you know, this was so-and-so, Joe or Jill, and the scans show that they had cancer yesterday, and today suddenly it's gone. Or other people having other illnesses. And the examples that were given in this article were from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It only covered these three faiths. So somebody went and dipped in a holy pond. Somebody went to a certain pilgrimage in Mecca, anywhere else, and they were cured. And these were documented, not just hearsay. So I was reading this, and as I was reading, I was looking up, see the response of my teacher, and he was very happy. Remember I said I was more zealous? So I was the Hindu. And these were the three other faiths, and it was talking about miracles in those faiths. And my teacher, a Hindu himself, being happy and impressed by hearing of the miracles in other faiths. He wasn't rebellious against them. He wasn't trying to, you know, try to say, oh, they can't have happened, or they, you know, it's some sort of mistake. He was very appreciative, and I was amazed at seeing that. And I continued to read, and I felt the article was one-sided. It failed to talk about miracles in Eastern faiths like Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism. So I felt there was an implicit bias in this article. I continued reading, and my teacher was happy right till the end, and he was nodding his head and all the rest of it. And then as I closed the magazine at the end, I said to him, well, how can all of these incidents be true? How could these miracles be true? How can their prayers all be working? And he was puzzled. And in a fraction of a second, he said, so what if they were all worshiping different gods? Ultimately, all prayers reach the same God. So right there, in that one statement, as I said, I was a young monk, a little zealous. Again, he completely destroyed whatever thought I had of, you know, East and West. For my teacher, there was no such thing as East or West, so he wasn't upset. for him, it was all universal. So that was another moment where I asked him these kind of questions and he gave me answers that really broke me out of my narrow keyhole perspective of the world and made me truly universal.
The universe has a marvelous way of appearing just when we need a reminder the most, just as you just shared in that example of the article you're translating and pondering. And this moment served as a beautiful opportunity for realization and personal growth.
Yes, company we keep is a very powerful force in how we evolve or devolve. So the company we keep consists of the people around us, our family, our friends, our community, but also the books we read, the news we listen to. Whatever we take in through our five senses is called company. As a principle in yoga, company is not only people, it's every sense perception that we have is a company that influences our mind and our well-being in some way. Just say sugar, right? So having sugar on the tongue is a form of company. It influences our emotions. It influences our health. Ultimately, it influences how we function daily. So everything that we take in through our five senses, that means through our eyes, through our ears, through our nose, through our mouth, and through our sense of touch, all of these things are company, and they all influence us in some way, very profoundly. Not just the things we hear, but the things we touch and the things we feel, the things we taste. So it's actually very profound. When we go deeper into meditation and yoga, we begin to realize the profound effects of these other forces, which we usually are completely oblivious of, which are buffeting us in various directions. And we are completely oblivious of that. So yeah, I would say the books important. They open us up to thought sometimes that we might not have had, or they force us to face thoughts that we don't usually entertain and to look at things from a new angle. But I do like to emphasize that the company we keep is also not limited to the people or the books around us. It's much more than that.
It's interesting you say that it's much more than that. Does that potentially come from mindfulness or awareness? And how do you see it aligning with modern scientific research in the field of mental health and overall well-being?
Mindfulness is something that humanity would have discovered throughout the world many thousands of years ago. The very fact that our thoughts affect our emotions and our emotions affect the way we feel, the way our heart beats, the way it may pacify us or the way it may anger us. And anger being one of the more vivid of those emotions, a person getting angry, shouting and yelling in the cave, right, 10,000 years ago, and then suddenly collapsing of a heart attack. People would have noticed sooner or later that anger somehow kills people. So our thoughts lead to anger would also have been intuited by people thousands of years ago. My point is that it's not rocket science. People who are introspective will sooner or later discover how there is a relationship between mind and matter, over mind and body. You'll be able to feel it. You'll be able to feel your heart fluttering when you're anxious and how that makes you feel, how it disturbs your decision-making or paralyzes your decision-making. A caveman could have discovered all of this, and I'm sure they did thousands of years ago. So mind over matter itself is not a great discovery in the sense that it's a modern discovery, but it is a great discovery in the sense that once we grasp hold of that and then try in some way to manage our mind so that we get better outcomes for our health and for our actions and decision-making. I think that's the important takeaway from this. And so mindfulness is basically about being aware of what's going on in your mind, being aware of one's thoughts and the connection between one's thoughts and one's actions. If you talk about mindfulness, or if you look at various articles on the internet, you're going to find 10,000 articles about what mindfulness is. And you will find different authors trying to pass or split certain hairs. And in their own way, they may be right. Because mindfulness is such a deep subject that you could really definitely split it in any way you want to, and you'd probably be right. Because 99.9% of our world is in our mind. And therefore, everything can be split. Everything can be passed. Everything can be looked at as half empty or half full. Because our world is in our mind for the most part. So mindfulness is about understanding our thoughts and where they come from. And after doing that, deciding on a certain set of thoughts as being your signpost for living your life. My teacher used to call it Janapanu. Janapanu means awareness. Again, if you go to the internet, someone will say, what's the difference between awareness and mindfulness and introspection? And somebody will be very cleverly trying to give certain definitions of awareness and certain definitions of mindfulness and definitions of introspection and showing how they are so distinct. But those are just getting into the weeds. And practical life is really not about that. It's about understanding the larger picture and getting on with the job of meditating and becoming mindful and becoming more quiet within and helping to spread that peace outside of us as well. So that's mindfulness. Basically, it's awareness, being mindful of our own thoughts, mindful of our circumstances, and mindful about our pre-chosen solutions to the situations around us. So supposing something triggers me and makes me angry. So I should be aware of what those triggers are, those situations, those certain words that tend to push my hot buttons. I have a list of them. They're ready for me at any time in my mind. And secondly, I'm also aware of the solutions. Okay, if this happens, someone says this word, this is what I'm going to use as my antidote so that I don't explode or I don't get upset or I don't get anxious. So that's what mind is. It's about awareness. And once we can keep that awareness, we keep our tranquility of mind, our stillness of mind. We preserve it. Preserving stillness of mind is the goal of yoga. The definition of yoga is yoga chitta vritti nirodha. That's a 10,000-year-old definition of yoga. One of the founding fathers, one of them, his name was Patanjali. He wrote one of the seminal books on yoga called the Yoga Sutras. And in that, he defines what yoga is. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the cessation of the whirling mind. So when our mind becomes still, stops whirling, that's when you are in a place called yoga, stillness, union.
If you're saying most of our world is in our mind, one could question, what is actually reality?
Politicians say the best. Perception is reality. The facts don't matter. That's reality. So people sometimes have a kind of rebellious attitude when I say that the facts don't matter. Well, of course, the facts matter. Facts do matter. But to every individual, they're all wearing their own goggles. Someone's wearing green, someone's wearing red, someone's wearing black, someone's wearing white. And because of those goggles, that prism through which they're looking at things, the facts change. The only indomitable facts which I think exist is 1 + 1 = 0. I mean, mathematics, I think, is the only thing in any language, in any culture, which remains the same. You could do calculus in Chinese, in Hindi, or you can do it in English or German, and calculus is the same, or just 1 + 1 is the same in any language. So if we're really talking about objective facts, then perhaps only mathematics meets that standard.
Do you believe people are actually taking the time to be mindful of their thoughts and allowing this awareness to come into their life, their world, their interactions with people?
I think they are. And one of the great services to that purpose has been in the United States, the flourishing of yoga and of mindfulness has led people to become more aware of it. Yoga and mindfulness are very much part of the life of people in the East, particularly in India, where it's a way of life. Yoga is even taught at schools and it's taught at every temple. But in the West, it's also been taught to a very good extent because it would talk about mind and about happiness and for gratitude for the things that we have. Gratitude is a sense of wellness which comes from our thoughts. So we have to address our thoughts to be grateful. But this kind of introspection has only happened in spiritual groups, usually. But since yoga, unfortunately, has been commercialized in America, it has exposed yoga, fortunately, to people so that they can actually get a spiritual outlook in life. So there's been a pro and a con of the commercialization of yoga in the United States, and the pro outweighs the con. The pro is that people have started looking inward and thinking about the mind and how it affects our health and the outcomes of our decisions.
So if I think about that even further, many people struggle with incorporating mindfulness into their busy lives. What are some practical tips you can offer to integrate mindfulness into this hectic schedule or hectic life we have?
When there is a will, there is a way. That's the first thing. My teacher was more busy than the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of India or the Prime Minister of Great Britain, if you look at the number of things he had to do during the day. Yet he always found time to help people. Where there's a will, there's a way. And particularly if we're disciplined, a timetable really helps. Our lives are sometimes a little fluid, right? So we go to sleep 20 minutes late, or we wake up 20 minutes late, 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. And if we look at the way we live our lives, if we can actually work a little bit more to a timetable, a little bit more like clockwork, though clockwork doesn't sound cool, working to a tighter schedule really does help us manage our time. And when minutes matter, then timetables matter. So minutes do matter. So that's the first thing. Even as monks, once even I said this to my teacher, I said, I don't have time. And he completely rebutted that. And he told me, make a timetable. That's the first thing he told me. He said, make a timetable and you will find time. So though we think and we have a perception that we are so busy, if we really analyze our day, we'll find that we can probably scrape another hour or 2 hours out of that day, which actually being wasted in some way. So that's the first thing. The second thing is if you truly feel you don't have time, then there's another thing that we used to do as monks. And for us, it was an instruction as well. That not a moment of our time was to be wasted, right? Idly. So even when we visited the restroom or when we were showering, we were in some way meditating or introspecting. People who don't have time, and it sounds weird, but if you go to the restroom 4 times a day, you're standing there, meditate. Go through your mind the things that you need to become aware of when you leave the restroom and get back to work or get back to your family. Use every moment of your life wisely. And if you don't have spare moments, then these are times that everyone has, because everyone has to go to the restroom, everyone has to shower. So these are times. Also, after that, while you're eating, not everybody's having a meeting while they're eating. You may be with your family once a day with one meal a day, and that would be a wonderful thing. But the other 2 meals, while you're having snacks, drinking coffee at the water cooler, it gives you 30 seconds, it gives you 1 minute. And you can make that start working like clockwork. If you start introspecting, being mindful as you take down that water and it goes down your throat into your tummy, you could be taking down positive thoughts, positive ideas, positive vibes. And being refreshed with that water, and you go back again to your office or to your family, you could be a renewed, rejuvenated person. So there's always time, and you don't have to make new time. You do already have time.
So I'm hearing you say, take the opportunity to do a time audit of your day.
Exactly.
Think about where you're spending your time, audit that, and then really ask yourself, is that time being used in a meaningful way? You've also touched on the importance of being present in every moment, being mindful in every moment. We have this tendency to go on autopilot. We're essentially in this culture where everything is instant gratification, instant coffee, or it's A to B mentality. And we're missing the opportunity to be mindful in every moment. What are some of the things you've seen or felt that we can do to stop this instant culture and become more present and slow down and come back to this remembering of awareness?
That's a very good question. It begins with taking a decision. One has to first take that decision strongly and say, I'm deciding to do this, like a New Year's resolution, but much stronger than that. New Year's resolutions are often too big, and that's why people can't follow through. They become unsustainable because they're too big. They demand such a huge change in people's lifestyle that people may give up, you know, just within a few days or a few weeks. So I'm not talking about that kind of strong resolution, but the kind of resolution that you could take which doesn't affect your life so dramatically that it becomes unsustainable. Small decision, something like this. When I go to the restroom, very simple. Or when I sit inside my car before I turn on the ignition. You could have, we used to carry sometimes, as I said, little pieces of paper with some mantra or something written on it, which we'd kind of open up whenever we had a moment and just refresh ourselves with who we are and what our goals are. Similarly, anybody can keep that kind of small piece of paper or have it on their phone. And just before you start up your car, or the first thing you do when you sit in the train or the bus, and then before you start scrolling out other things, just have a small decision that I'm going to read this one paragraph, which I've stored on my phone, and then I'm going to go and see the rest of my social media. These are small things that we can do. I think it's about wanting to do them, understanding the importance of doing them, that determines the determinedness for us, how determined we are to follow through with the decision. We take decisions about things, but if we don't know the importance of it, then it becomes easy for us to discard that decision. So even before we make a decision to meditate or be mindfulness, we do have to understand the gravity and the importance of mindfulness and how it is something that we should not miss under any circumstances, and particularly when it's only 30 seconds of it. So there are a lot of building blocks around this. It's a learning curve. It's not like stepping onto a treadmill and starting to walk. It's more like starting to crawl, finding your legs when you're a child and you're still just trying to learn to stand up. That's the journey that we are all on.
So you mentioned journey. As a former monk yourself, you must have quite a unique perspective on happiness and spiritual wellness. How do you bridge the pursuit of success in today's modern world, this inner spiritual fulfillment?
Success should be a mission to help others. And then that becomes something so big, it's bigger than ourselves. And it's not about self-acclaim. It's not about self-adulation. It's not about buying things and becoming rich to buy ourselves the pleasures of the world, but it's about becoming rich to use that wealth to help other people. There are so many billionaires in this world today and millionaires who live very, very ordinary lifestyles. They don't live in mansions, even though they can afford them, and they're using their wealth to help other people. So success should become a mission rather than an ambition. Ambitions destroy ourselves. They destroy our families. They destroy our communities. Ambitious people cause more harm than good. But people with missions are very humble, and they're always looking at how to help other people. And when things become very difficult, they don't give up. They keep going. They keep going. They put every ounce of their energy into achieving that goal. So success is not bad. Success is a wonderful thing because you can help tens of thousands, if not millions, of people with success, even if you don't reach that far. But if you have enough success, at least you can take care of your own family. At least perhaps you can help your neighbor. So I feel that happiness is about having a mission in one's life. When we have a mission, you're less likely to feel dejected. You're going to feel more buoyant, and you have that courage to continue even when the going gets tough. When the going gets tough, you're not going to say, poor me, look at my situation, I can't pay my bills. even though that's a very unfortunate situation, you'd be thinking more like, oh, I can't help my community because I'm not earning enough. That's a different thought from saying, I can't pay my bills because I'm not earning enough. So the way our outlook in life is that we don't necessarily have to change the things that we're doing. We don't need to change our trajectory. We just need to transform the reason behind the things that we do. What is our purpose, say, becoming an astronaut? What is our purpose for becoming a great scientist or a great doctor or even a monk? What's the purpose of becoming a monk? So anything that we do, any vocation that we choose in our lives, if the purpose is about others, if it's about service, then we're going in the right direction and we bring happiness to ourselves as well as to other people.
So where and how can individuals who are feeling lost or uncertain start to find purpose and direction in their lives?
Your local charity. Remember I said success is about helping other people. Charities are amongst those few organizations in the world which are about helping other people. It's an easy place to get started. Visit your local charity, your library, your church, your temple, your synagogue, Gurudwara, wherever you may be going, soup kitchen, go to a hospital. Find ways to serve. Try 3 or 4 different places and you'll start to see that the world needs your help. The world does need you. People need you. You are not an unknown, insignificant person. You are very significant. You are an important cog in the machinery of the world. You just haven't found your place perhaps there right now. You're sitting still on the assembly line. You need to get off that conveyor belt and get fitted into that larger vehicle. Remember, all of us are part of a team. None of us can be successful alone. We all serve together. And that's what I mean by a machine, the machine of humanity, the machine of compassion. If you want to send bread to Africa, you're not going to bake it yourself, are you, and send it there? Some people might be able to do that. But more likely, we would fund the bakery or the baker, and the baker would bake the bread and send it to Africa. We all have to be part of a group, and that's what I mean. So we need to get engaged. Everyone is important in this world. Everyone is significant. If you're feeling insignificant, it means maybe because you haven't become part of one of those groups where you play a part, an important part, in helping the whole machine work. The organization which I used to belong to as a monk, everyone worked together, you know, like the different cogs in a watch. And the outcomes were always beautiful, and they still are. You know, it's a charitable organization, and it's growing in leaps and bounds because everyone is significant, everyone is important, everyone's appreciated, and everyone's contributing. So wherever you are, in whichever faith, in whichever community, even if you don't necessarily have a spiritual outlook in life, you can still get involved to help other people, even in a soup kitchen or any other place like that, or a hospital. So charities are the place to find our purpose in life, because charities are what open us up to other people's pain rather than for letting us languish in our own frustrations.
Just by going and visiting your own charities, we're going back to what you said earlier. You're allowing yourself to have the opportunity to do some introspection through service. You're beginning to learn more about yourself and where your passions and where potentially your purpose may grow from. You're engaging with the larger community. So people who have similar interests or similar purposes to yourself can then engage in meaningful dialogue to potentially help and make better impact.
Exactly. The best friends you'll ever make in your life will probably be at a charity, because they're also thinking about things bigger than themselves. They themselves are also thinking about helping other people. And they themselves are not just talking about it or thinking about it, they're actually doing it. As you just said, everyone's busy. Who isn't busy in this world, right? Everyone's busy, and yet they found time to help somebody. That is humongous. Imagine the determinedness of that person to go there and to help. That person is really determined. That person is sacrificed from his or her personal life. They're not watching that Netflix movie or whatever, and they're actually at that charity serving someplace. They could be doing so many other things. They're giving their donations, and they're giving their expertise, which outside they would be charging for. That same thing which they're doing in the charity writing or reading or helping or serving in any other way, given their technical expertise, they could be charging for that. And yet they're not. They're actually grateful for being able to contribute it. So those are wonderful human beings, wherever you find them, in charities. The best people on this planet are to be found at charities. You want to make friends, best place to go. Find the best of humanity there.
So how can individuals then navigate feelings of disconnection and rediscover fulfillment and direction in their life?
That's where you go. Connect with great humanitarians at charities. As I said, the company we keep is so important. Surround ourselves with people who have purpose. Then it's more likely that we will also gain a purpose. If we surround ourselves with people who have direction, have a mission, it's more likely that we will find direction and a mission. So charities are kind of the place where we go, where we find peace and we can introspect. Those people also are most likely to be highly introspective people, people who have thought about life, people who have gone through their own sufferings and have found solutions at charities. Engaging with them, asking them questions, ordinary people just like ourselves, and that conversation with them is going to be such a powerful influence on your life, more than even reading a book.
It gives you a different perspective or helps you question your own belief systems or approaches. You said it earlier, and I'll paraphrase a little bit, but we all get caught up in our own little bubbles. And what we don't realize is that we're actually part of a much bigger bubble. It's almost like that ripple effect in water. And that's what impact is about. And that's what being of service is about. Sometimes in this modern way of life, we often say to ourselves, well, I don't know how much impact I'm really going to make by going out and doing this, so I'm not going to do it. But what we don't realize is just having that opportunity to be of service or help someone else.
You're right.
For the greater good, it really does create impact. One impact to one person speaks far much greater volume than I think we tend to realize. And especially in an age now where everything is social media. Oh, I'm going onto social media. I'm going to go follow this person. I'm going to follow that person. I'm going to like that person. But what we don't realize is half of what we see on social media isn't really reality. It's actually going out and doing something that is of greater good and greater service that is actually going to cause impact. Now, I'm not demonizing technology. We need technology for a number of things, but let's not focus all our energies on just those things.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. And again, part of introspection, you know, is about what do we need, right? So it's interesting that, you know, we think we need social media, but did we need it 30 years ago? So this is what I meant by so much of the world being within our minds. I read in an article once that 1% of consumer items never had a market. I'm old enough to remember, Nilesh, when there were only 4 different cereals available at the supermarket: cornflakes, Rice Krispies, Cocoa Puffs, and Sugar Puffs. Maybe porridge. That was it. 4. And we rejoiced in our 4 cereals. That's all we needed. And now today, suddenly we need 200 cereals. The market never existed, but it was created. And then we thought, oh, I need this. We didn't need it until it was invented. There was I'll give you an example. Socrates, one of the great Greek philosophers, used to live almost like a monk. He was married, but he lived like a monk, very simply. And he used to teach his students that kind of simplicity. And once he went into the marketplace, and it was a bustling place with all of these different stalls selling different things, perfumes, and curtains, and clothes, and spices, and whatever. And he was going to each of these stalls, and he was amazed, and he was looking at each of those items, and he was picking them up and putting them back down and then moving to the next one. And one of his students happened to be in the market. He was surprised. He had never seen his teacher to ever go into that marketplace. And he went, he said, "Socrates, I'm amazed to see you here in this mundane place where all these things are for sale." And Socrates said, "Yes, I'm amazed to see how many things there are that I don't need." Look at the difference. We walk through a mall And I want one of those. I want one of those. I need one of I need that. I need that. I need that. And Socrates can walk through and say, I don't need that. I don't need that. I don't need that. I don't need that. That is the breakthrough in psychological liberation. Not being a puppet of what is being presented, all these shiny objects, these smartphones, these plasma televisions, these electric cars. And I'm not saying go back to the Stone Age. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying to be aware that we need none of these things. We just need our family, a roof over your head, and a hot meal. That's reality. Good health. If we can stay that focused, and then the rest are just bonuses, right? Then we have this, all of these technologies. Great, wonderful. Don't have to reject them. But in our mind, we don't have to say, I need them. Once you need something outside of yourself or outside of your family, you have become a slave to it. It impoverishes us. That needs you. Many people are waking up to this now when they're saying that even on social media, the social media is not the product. We are the user. That's kind of disgraceful. Whereas we are the product. We are the lab rats when we are on social media. We are being sold our data or whatever, everything else. We are the experiment. We think we are using the media, but the media is actually using us. And I'm not saying don't use social media again. I'm just saying that we need to have that psychological awareness that amongst the sheep, you are the shepherd. Do not become the sheep. Sometimes that happens because we get so caught up in things that we think we need. Psychologically, we become immersed in them in a sense of oneness instead of standing aloof from those sheep and standing upright with integrity and with dignity as the shepherd. So again, I said, I'm not against technology. I love it. My teacher loved it. He loves science as well and spirituality, but everything has its context. And as I said, for when we say we need something, then we need to really think about that. I mean, if we take care of our health, how much health, how many medicines would we need? Today, the health industry has become trillions of dollars value. Pharmaceutical companies, other companies are making trillions. If we learn to just control what we eat, how much we eat, a lot of those medicines, a lot of those treatments wouldn't be required. We require them sometimes because of the way we live, our lifestyle, the way we think even. As I said, thinking causes our anger or our anguish, our anxiety. That leads to our blood pressure, that leads to eating comfort foods, which leads to heart disease, which leads to heart attacks and strokes. And all sorts of things happen because of our lifestyle and the way we think. So what do we really need? Do we need the medicines? Yes, of course, we still need the medicine. So it's cool. Even I would not reject it if I needed that kind of healthcare. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that more importantly, we need to control what we eat. We need to control what we think so that we need things outside of us less.
It's fascinating you say that. So it's almost as if at times our minds can craft a misleading narrative, seizing control and leading us down a path shaped by distorted perceptions.
Yes, it is the business model of businesses to make us think we need something. Subliminal messages which we are sent, they are there to create a sense of inferiority in us. If I don't have that, my goodness, what will I look like? What will people think of me if I walk around with this out-of-date phone, which is 3 years old or 4 years old, or this old model of this or that? What will people think of me? And hey, look, I need that fancy new feature. I need that new resolution in the camera. You never did. You never even knew what resolution was. We were walking around without cameras in our phones. And I never had a phone. There was no such thing as a mobile phone. I had to go home or walk into a phone booth to make a phone call. And life was fine until suddenly this shiny object was shown to me. And I said, wow, I need that. And then that whole, that downward slope happened where for the next 20 years or 30 years or 40 years of my life, I've been paying for these phones, something I never really needed. We already talk too much, right? I mean, look how much I've been talking in this interview. I talk too much. And yet these are objects which make money out of us talking. the, you know, the cell phone cards, which used to be there in the olden days. You get a card and you put money into your phone so you could keep talking. They're making us talk rather than introspect. And they're making other people millions of and trillions of dollars.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying earlier, the company we keep in the form of our five senses. And when I think about what you've just articulated and shared, it's generating fear, right?
You're right.
Fear, yes. If I don't have this, I'm missing out on something. Now, fear in itself creates that fight or flight response in our bodies.
Yes.
And when you were talking earlier, fear, historically, hundreds of years ago, was actually a good thing to have in healthy dosages because it was a survival mechanism. Now, fear is almost being monetized for people, which is absolutely crazy. And I think of something that you'd mentioned earlier as well, and I really did want to get back to that, is this concept of the company we keep our five senses. What we take in from those senses is actually being channeled up into the mind.
Yes.
And it's our mind that's creating these stories. And it's our mind that is shooting out these responses and all the systems we have within our body. But what I'm hearing you say is we need to get out of our minds because our mind is not the engine. There's something bigger.
Absolutely. There is something bigger. And that moves then into the field of spirituality. And scientists, of course, will steer clear of that discussion. They'd rather not even talk about mind. Many scientists today, I mean, since the birth of psychology, people are talking about mind, but some scientists today are just saying there's no such thing as mind, it's just a brain. And some scientists are saying that, well, mind is an emergent quality of the brain, the sum of the parts being greater, the whole being more than the sum of the parts. So there are different perspectives about the mind. And without getting into the weeds there, this much we can, I suppose, practice on a practical level. And that is, there are such things as thoughts. And these thoughts are either helpful or not helpful. How do we know whether they're helpful or not helpful? Well, if they hurt our health, I suppose we can assume that they're not helpful. If they hurt our family and our community, then we can assume that those thoughts are not helpful. And so after we've decided on that, then we can think that who is the viewer of those thoughts? And unless we go very deep into meditation and start to still the mind, until then you'll think that you are your thoughts. Many people feel that they are their thoughts. And I've gotten this feedback, of course, from many of the people I've taught meditation to. Even myself, initially, when I was a youth, I used to think I was my thoughts until I started meditating. And I suddenly realized that, eventually realized that I am an observer of my thoughts. Thoughts kind of sit in front of me and I'm behind them looking at them. I'm distinct from my thoughts. I am not my thoughts. And I can choose my thoughts. I can swipe them away or I can swipe them back. So I'm in charge. I may not be in charge of the thoughts that occur to me, but I am in charge of whether to keep them or discard them. So that's the important part of being mindful. We need to take a control of our thoughts. And to really take control of our thoughts, we need to become still in our mind. And when we become still, we realize that we are an observer. So yogis call it kshetra and kshetrajna. Those are two Sanskrit words. Kshetra means the field. Kshetrajna means the knower of the field. So the field is the field of perception, the thoughts and everything around us. And you become the knower of that field, like the data scientist who's going through all of this data and passing through it and keeping some and rejecting other parts. You are like that shepherd amongst the sheep. So that is such an important component of understanding that we have a deeper self which resides distinct from our thoughts. People who engage deeply with meditation eventually come to that experience.
Scientific studies have actually begun to validate the health benefits of yoga and meditation. Which of these benefits do you find most compelling and why?
The most important of the benefits of yoga and meditation are those which help improve your stillness of mind. We have to keep coming back to that, your tranquility of mind. The disturbance of one's mind, even if you have a healthy body, disturbances in your mind will create an unhealthy body. even if you have a healthy body and healthy diet and healthy lifestyle, the disturbances in your mind will still destroy all of that internally. Unhealthy thoughts lead to an unhealthy body. You may still have, you know, your six pack. You may still have all the biceps and everything else, and maybe of perfect weight and muscle and bone and other ratios may all be perfect, but your blood pressure and other functionings of your organs internally will be dysfunctional, and that will lead to disease. So there are so many people who, you know, who are very fit and they go home and they suddenly pass away. There's so many people who look fit when they go for their annual checkup, they've got four or five blockages. Of course, sometimes this is due to just it's part of their family history, but sometimes it's part of their thoughts. It's because of the way they think. Remember, I read about one article about one doctor who said, the person who angers me, and he was a kind of very irritable doctor. So patients going in and asking him questions really irritated him. So he himself said it. He said that the patient who angers me will be the one that cures me. And it happened. It was in California, I think, many decades ago. And he passed away. His patient asked him some questions, which he felt were so silly. And he kind of yelled back and he had a heart attack right there. So important is our mind, more important than even our lifestyles, our thought styles, because the mind can undo all of that in a moment. So meditation is far more important than yoga, though yoga has become more popular than meditation is. You just, you know, you're flexing your muscles, you go to a yoga studio, you become more bendy, and there are immediate effects which you feel when you stretch your muscles, you get this release of endorphins in your body and you feel good and you make incremental improvements, right? I mean, you go there and first you couldn't bend and now you can slowly bend more and more. And you see your progress and that you're able to do yoga postures you couldn't do before. And they lead to a high. You have the release of endorphins, but you also have the mental satisfaction of having improved and being, you kind of become an expert yogi to an extent. And you're able to do things that you're able to climb the stairs and sit down and play on the floor and play with your children or clean the house and do so many things you couldn't do easily before. So yoga has become more popular because it has more immediate effects on your body, which you can recognize and appreciate. But more important than the physical exercises or yoga is the meditation side, which helps heal your mind.
If there was one daily practice that you would recommend to our listeners to enhance their overall well-being, what would it be and why? And would you mind guiding us through some real basic steps to get us started on this journey?
Prevention is better than cure. Meditation, in some senses, is a cure. It's not so much a prevention. And what is prevention? So prevention would be, which my teacher always called, Janaparam, which means awareness. If we can become aware of our thoughts, then our mind will be still, more still than it usually is. And therefore, the need for meditation would be lessened. That's why in yoga, knowledge is the most important quality to have. If one has knowledge, your mind is already still because it hasn't become agitated. So knowledge, wisdom. Socrates himself, one of my favorite philosophers himself said it, said the root of all evil is ignorance. The root of all evil is ignorance. And the root of all good is knowledge. Even in yoga, knowledge is held as highest. When you wake up from your nightmare, that's knowledge. You've woken up into a reality. Oh, you're safe in bed. You're not really in this horrible other place, you know, suffering. You wake up and immediately you feel good. There's another higher reality. We are still asleep even when we are awake. And that wakefulness is what we call awareness. It's knowledge, the state of supreme highest knowledge. It's called paravidya in yoga, in the language of the yogis. Paravidya means the highest knowledge. And that's the knowledge of one's self and to be in charge of one's thoughts. So that's the most important thing. Get an idea of what are the thoughts in your mind that agitate you. Make a list, get a piece of paper, get a pen. What are the things that irritate you? Is it politics? Is it baseball? Is it bad drivers on the road? What are the things that really trigger you? make a list of them, be specific about what actually within those topics trigger you, and then write down what you will think in response to that when it occurs to keep you calm. So you've got an answer to it, an antidote. That is what we need to keep. What my teacher said, awareness, Janpur. Awareness is knowledge, and knowledge is peace. Knowledge is tranquility. And it's quite simple to do, as I said. Just keep a record of what triggers you and try to write down how you would calm yourself down in that situation when it happens. Or negate the thought right there in the bud and say, hey, if this thought occurs to me, I know that it's fake. It's a false representation and I needn't entertain it. It needn't disturb me.
Awareness is knowledge. Knowledge is peace. Knowledge is tranquility. That's a beautiful way of wrapping up our conversation today, Sanjay. It's been an absolutely insightful conversation for me and hopefully for our listeners. The Yoga Miracle by Sanjay Patel. If you've not read it, go take a look. It's an inspiring piece of literature and many more insightful ways for you to lead a life without limits. Sanjay, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute blessing for me, and I'm truly grateful for all your insights.
Thank you very much for having me, and all credit goes to my teacher and my parents. Whatever I've learned, the credit goes to them.
Thank you so much, Sanjay, and thanks everyone for joining me on another episode of Limitless Lives.